You know, it's a great time of year to be a gardener, isn't it? You get the first signs of spring. They're kind of showing themselves. And I think it's exciting to think about the potential your garden has for a great season. Larry Mueller here. And welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. We love having our great UW Extension horticulture educators on at any time of the year, but especially when we're at the start of a new growing season. It's great to have their depth and breadth of knowledge available to us. And we have one of those guests with us today. Diana Alfuth is the UW Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls, and she's joining us today from our WPR studios in Eau Claire. Diana, welcome back to Garden Talk.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back. I tell you what, it's always fun. And there's, you know, there is a little bit of a hint of spring in the air. I know a lot of people are anxious to get outdoors. Assuming there's no snow on the ground, what conditions are necessary for getting the earliest seeds in the ground?
Whatever the air temperature is, that's one thing. But really, as far as planting seeds in the garden goes, what we're worried about more is soil temperature, because the different seeds need enough warmth in the soil in order for them to germinate. So even though, you know, it seemed like spring last week, a couple of snowstorms here in between kind of shut down our spring fever a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's going to be warming up again here in the next few days. So really what we have to be monitoring is the soil temperature before you actually get out there and plant things.
What are some of the earliest seeds that you can direct sow into the garden?
Well, what we're looking at are what we call the cool season crops. And those are things like lettuce and spinach. Things like broccoli and cauliflower are also cool season crops, although we usually plant those indoors and then transplant the transplants outside. But what you should do is, if you're ever looking for a gift to put on your gift list for your birthday or the holidays, somebody wants to buy you a gift, put on there a soil thermometer, because that's really what all gardeners should have before they go planting in the springtime. And you put that soil thermometer down into the soil about 3 to 4 inches deep and monitor what the soil temperature is. And until it's to 40 degrees, you don't want to be planting anything, because nothing is going to germinate well below 40 degrees. That's the minimum temperature for things like beets and broccoli, cabbage. Carrots can go out when it's 40 degrees. Leeks, almost all kinds of lettuce, onions can go out when it's 40 degrees. Peas are one of our cool season crops. Radishes can go out when it's 40 degrees. And even though 40 degrees is the minimum, a little bit warmer than that is actually better, because the warmer the soil, the faster the seeds are going to germinate. And the problem is, if a seed is sitting in the soil waiting to germinate, the longer it's sitting there not germinated, the more susceptible it is to some kind of peril that will reach seeds in the garden. So fungus or rotting from, you know, too much moisture, or field mice or insects or something that come and eat the seed, or birds that come and pick them out. So really our goal is, when we put the seeds in the soil, we want them to germinate as quickly as possible, because then they're going to be off to a good start. So even though 40 degrees may be the minimum temperature for things like spinach and lettuce and carrots, you might want to wait until it's a little bit warmer than that, and then you'll get faster germination.
But then if you get the germination and then suddenly we have a late spring snowstorm, or the temperatures really drop, is that a problem with that?
For these cool season crops, it usually isn't. I know my mom always used to say the best peas are the ones that it snows on. And I don't know if there's any validity to that or not. But these cool season crops can be up and growing before the last frost of the year. So they can handle a little bit of frost. Now, if we got super, super cold stuff, which obviously we don't expect for, you know, a long length of time, you could have some damage. But most of these things can take air temperatures that are below freezing, and once they're up and growing. The warm season crops, of course, we have to wait until after the last frost. And they're going to need even warmer soil temperatures. So things like beans and cucumbers, any of the vine crops, pumpkin and squash, they need the soil temperature to be more like 60 degrees or even 65 degrees in some cases. And those plants can't handle a late spring frost. They'll be killed by it. So we really have to wait on those before we start planting any of that stuff.
I'm usually one of these people, too. For peppers or tomatoes, I wait well past what my neighbors are planting.
And, you know, that's a really good idea. Up in the northern part of Wisconsin, in the northern half, you know, here in Pierce County, Eau Claire, where we are, we're about in the middle. But the northern half, anyway, of the state, we really shouldn't be planting any of those warm season things like tomatoes and peppers until Memorial Day. And even though we might have really warm weather before that, you can't trust it. And if you plant them too early, even if we don't get a frost that kills them, they're not going to be growing or very vigorous when it's the night temperatures are pretty cool. So it's better if you wait until you've got consistently warm weather, and then they can really take off and do their best. You don't really gain much by putting them out there a week or two earlier if they're just going to sit out there and shiver when it's cold nights or even cool days. So those warm season things, like I said, I don't think you gain a whole lot by sneaking them out there a week or two earlier.
No, and you do lose. I learned that lesson with peppers in particular.
And, right. And I remember, you know, years where we, I remember one year where we had frost on June 21st and we were out covering our garden. And so you just don't, I mean, that obviously that's a rarity, but you can't, even though our frost-free date, our average frost-free date, you know, is something we can look up. There's always that late frost. And even, like I said, even if it's not frost, it's still cooler nights and cooler days yet. And tomatoes and vine crops, those sorts of things really like some heat.
Diana Alfeth, our guest today, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Pierce County. You can join in. We have callers online already, but there's a line open for you yet at 1-800-642-1234. You can also go to our Facebook page. The title of that page is The Larry Mueller Show. Go there and you can post photos and questions and comments. And you can, of course, also email us at talk@wpr.org. We would love to hear from you. And again, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Kristen in Roberts. Kristen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Diana. Diana, I have, I'm about just north of River Falls, actually, so it's nice to have you on the show. I have some ornamental grasses in my ditch that I think started out as just a little tuft maybe 10 years ago. We've lived here about 5 years, and they just are growing and encroaching on the yard and expanding in the ditch. And I'm trying to replant with some wildflowers and native grasses this year. And I really need some help figuring out how to prepare the soil and how to try and get rid of this kind of invasive grass prior to trying something else.
Mm.
Okay. Is that one? It is nice to have a caller from up in my neighborhood here and and in our hardiness zone. So is this, when you say ornamental grass, is this one that gets the big plumes on it?
Yeah.
In the Okay.
Yeah.
So that's probably one of the invasive species of Miscanthus. And there are a few places around the area where you can see that it's just kind of taken over the ditches and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What it does is it spreads by rhizomes, by underground roots. And so that patch gets bigger and bigger and bigger every year. So it's like quackgrass. And it's really, really hard to get rid of. So digging it up will knock it back some, but if there are some roots that are left in the soil, it's likely to sprout back up. So really the only way to get rid of quackgrass or this form of the Miscanthus is going to be with an herbicide. And so if you can, you know, spritz the areas where you want to plant things with Roundup, that's going to be the best kind of a way to kill those root systems so that you're not continuously dealing with them sprouting back up. The challenge is that this miscanthus is basically a warm season grass. So quackgrass is already green out there, and so we can deal with it sooner in the year. But you have to wait until this grass is growing, and so that's not likely going to be until into June before you can use Roundup on it, because the Roundup has to touch the leaves of the plant and then go down into the root system through there. So you know, you're not going to be able to get an early start on this, I guess, is my point.
Mm-hmm. And we've cleared all the dead grass away, just trying to get an early start, but it sounds like we won't be able to. My other concern is that it's crept within about like 3 feet of my fruit and vegetable garden, and so I feel a little uncomfortable with, you know, the real strong herbicides like Roundup.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that's a little safer to use?
Again, what Roundup or glyphosate, how it works is it doesn't work by getting into the soil and being taken up by the roots. It works by contacting the leaf and then going down into the plant. And so as long as you don't get any drift on your fruit or vegetable plants, you're not going to damage those plants, okay? Now, there's still, you know, people have legitimate concerns that, well, you just don't know what happens when it gets in the soil, that kind of a thing. You'll have super low contact with the soil anyway. So if it were me, I actually wouldn't worry about that too much. But if you don't want to use Roundup, and that's fine, then your option is to dig it out. So, you know, if you start digging and you dig out as many of those roots as possible, like I said, there'll be some pieces of roots that are left behind that'll likely sprout back up. But if you're diligent about it and you keep watching for it, and every time you see a little bit of it coming up, you dig that out, eventually you can hopefully starve out those roots that are underground yet. And then, the patch will die off or at least be beat back into the ditch and away from your fruits and vegetables. So those are the options.
Should I be waiting until later in the fall then to try and plant these different seeds that I had in mind? Or
You could plant them.
Yeah. The thing is that, again, Roundup does not get into the soil and stop things from germinating. It only kills what it comes in contact with the green leaves of. So there, you know, if you read the label on it, it will say something like, don't plant seeds in there for, it's a short time.
A few days.
I can't remember for sure, but I thought it was like 3 to 5 days or something like that. Because again, it does not work by being in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So you do, you know, want to be, you know, just read the label to make sure that, you know, you're following those instructions. But typically once you spray it, the thing with Roundup or glyphosate is that whatever you spray, it doesn't die immediately. And that can be pretty frustrating. But the plant, if you spray this grass with it, it'll stay green for about a week before it'll first start going off color. Even though the plant after a couple of days is probably dead, it's just not admitting it yet, because the herbicide has gone down into the roots. So if you use the glyphosate herbicide, when you spray it, you should let it sit for a couple of days. But after that point, you can start digging it up and working it up, because that herbicide would have gone down into the roots and affected the mm-hmm. weed enough that it's going to die. But it doesn't look like it on the surface for about a week. And so people get very frustrated with that. But there's no need to go out and respray it after a couple of days because it doesn't look like it's dying, because it is. But after that, once you dig that stuff up, you can go ahead and plant your seeds or other plants, whatever you want, pretty quickly after that.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Kristen. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Diana Alfuth, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Pierce County. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer today for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on next week on Garden Talk, the Gourd Girl joins us, Terry Schmidt. Well, it'll be great to see her again. She'll have some tips for growing gourds, but also what to do with them after you harvest them. She's a great artist, and it's really always a lot of fun to talk with her. And that's coming up next week on Garden Talk. Right now, visiting with Diana Alfuth, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. And I think we have one open line at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And, of course, as always, we'd love to hear from you. Rebecca in Waupaca, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering, with mulch, we're wondering if we have to clear out the sticks and leaves that got into the mulch areas before we lay down new mulch, or can we just put the new mulch over that mess?
Okay. I'm guessing you're talking about you're putting down a wood mulch and you have wood mulch underneath?
Yes.
Okay. I wouldn't clear anything out.
No, I wouldn't either.
I mean, okay. It just kind of adds to the mulch stuff. It's all organic matter, so it's all going to decompose eventually and stuff. So as long as, you know, visually it's, you know, you cover it up and you don't have sticks and junk looking out that bothers you visually from a horticulture standpoint, it'd be just fine.
Okay, good news for us then. Thank you.
Yes, yep. Save work whenever possible.
Absolutely. We had a Facebook question from Mike wondering if you could advise on the best options for dirt or compost for new raised beds for vegetable gardening. He's also curious about how deep to make the beds, you know, with the dirt or with whatever you're recommending. We're planning on 2 or 3 4x8 beds.
Okay. Well, raised beds are can be really, really good for certain situations. So if you have crummy existing soil, rocky or, you know, super sandy or that kind of a thing, then bringing in soil from somewhere else is a great option. The other reason people build raised beds is so that you don't have to bend over as far. And there are some advantages to raised beds. They warm up earlier in the spring, and we were just talking about getting that soil temperature up where it needs to be to plant seeds. So that you can get a earlier start if you have raised beds because the soil warms up quicker because it's above ground, and it dries out quicker. So, you know, if it's the spring muddy season, you can get in working the soil sooner. But there are disadvantages to raised beds, too. So I always tell people to really think through it. Raised beds are cute. You know, they're pretty, they're neat and stuff like that. But you have to think of the practical use of them as well. So, for example, if you have an in-ground garden now and you're thinking you're going to build some cute raised beds, think about how you're going to work up the soil in those raised beds. Because when it's in-ground, you can, you know, bring your big rototiller out there in the spring to work up the soil. And that's hard to do with a raised bed. You have to either lift the tiller up in there, and then even when you use it, the soil kind of kicks out over the edges of the raised bed. So think about that. Make sure that you truly want raised beds. And like I said, they have some really good advantages to them. What we typically want for vegetable gardens is a root zone of at least 8 to 10 inches. So you can make your raised bed only 6 inches tall if you're digging into the native soil as well, so, and loosening that up. Otherwise, if you know what you have down there is rocky and yucky kind of a thing, then you would want to build your raised bed a 10-inch high raised bed minimum, and then fill that with the soil that you're going to bring in. And that way, like I said, most of our vegetables being annuals, 8 to 10 inches is the root zone that we're looking at. As far as what kind of soil to bring in, if you can, with an outdoor raised bed, you don't want it to be just potting soil. And potting soil is considered usually soilless, meaning there's no actual sand, silt, or clay in it. It's all things like compost and decomposed bark and maybe some perlite and stuff in there. But that will break down pretty quickly over time. So in an actual raised bed, you'd probably want some actual soil in there as well. So if you can find a source in the area for black dirt, it's always called, or topsoil is probably a better name for it, and bring that in. And then you really should get amend it with organic matter as well. So adding in some compost is a great idea because all of our vegetables, they're going to do better in high organic matter in the soil. Organic matter is a great thing. And then you really should do a soil test on that as well because you don't know where it came from. And even though it might look like nice black dirt or topsoil with the compost in it, you don't know what the pH is and what the phosphorus and potassium levels are. So doing a soil test of whatever it is that you bring in is really a valuable thing. Soil tests are something that, you know, we should be doing about every 5 years because stuff can change in 5 years. Phosphorus levels and pH can change. The pH is determined by the parent material from that topsoil. So, again, you don't know where it came from. It could be a really high pH or a really low pH, and that's going to affect your vegetable plants' abilities to take up nutrients out of the soil. So, that would be my recommendation.
Sounds like a good one. Let's go to Andrew in Muskego next. Hi, Andrew. Thank you for calling.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for your time. What is on your mind?
I own a greenhouse in Muskego, a commercial greenhouse. So I was listening, and I just had to add to your guest's thing there about the cool season crops. That another great way to start them. I started to do lettuce a while ago in a cold frame. So I put plastic over a frame and grow in there, and it really boosts my my season. You know, the growing season when you get a sunny day.
That is absolutely right. And, you know, if you really have a good cold frame and you get those sunny days and stuff, it's amazing how long during the season you can grow lettuce and some of these leafy greens and cool season crops in there. And that cold frame, like you say, on a sunny day, that's heating up the soil within that cold frame. So that's going to speed the germination in there as well.
And on the other end, too, in the fall.
Exactly.
Yep. Oh, yeah, you can... You can grow a lot of things, you know, pretty long. And they, you know, yeah, I mean, I start lettuce in March, you know, mid-March. And you can really, really get a boost with just putting some plastic over a couple of beds.
Yeah, makes good sense. Andrew, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Barbara in Green Bay, you are next. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning. I have another raised bed question.
Okay.
I am excited about having a raised bed installed in May by volunteers through the university here in Green Bay. They'll be building it, and they'll be also filling it with soil. I plan to have square foot gardening, but I'm wondering what you think about the feasibility of planting strawberry plants in there.
Strawberry plants are a perennial, obviously. And what happens with raised beds is, you know, if you're growing a perennial in the ground freezes from the surface in the winter. And sure, it freezes, the plants freeze, but the soil temperature only gets down into usually the upper 20s. So if you were to stick a soil temperature in that frozen ground, it would be frozen at about maybe 27 degrees or so in the middle of winter. Raised beds or containers, anything like that, also freezes from the side. So when our air temperature is, you know, zero, then that soil is freezing down to a much colder temperature. And so the roots of those perennial plants are frozen down to a much colder temperature, and that's usually what kills them. So, you know, any kind of a perennial plant is, you know, hardy if it's planted in the ground, but not necessarily hardy if it's planted in a container. And a raised bed is basically a large container. Now, if you had a, I don't know what the dimensions, the size of your raised bed
is. 4x8, and I was thinking of having strawberry plants, probably one plant per foot, only on two rows on the 4 foot side.
Mm-hmm. So they'll be up near the edges of that raised bed.
Uh-huh.
And so those roots are going to be subjected to very, very cold temperatures.
Uh-huh.
And so I would be pretty leery about them making it through the winters.
Good.
Now you could do something to help them in the winter. So, for example, if you took straw bales or something and packed them up against the sides of that raised bed in the winter to try to insulate it some so that the cold would have to go, you know, through the straw bales before it gets to the raised bed, that might help.
Okay.
But it's still...
I was thinking about that, too, and then I thought, oh, but that's kind of a pain in the neck.
It is. It all depends on how much you love homegrown strawberries.
I've already had them in hanging baskets, and they're wonderful.
There's those strawberry pots, those terracotta pots that have the holes in the sides that you can put strawberries in and stuff, too.
Sure.
But, unfortunately, our winters being what they are, it doesn't always work.
I'm so glad I asked you, and I appreciate your information.
All right. Well, good luck.
Good luck, Barb. Thank you very much for calling. I suppose Barb could, get those straw bales, and then she could take them off and start a straw bale garden to the side, too.
That's true. That'd
be another way to do it. Larry and Madison, your turn. Hi, Larry. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. Two quick questions. One, if I plant my sweet corn too close to the field corn, am I going to get some unwanted cross-pollination? And the second question is, do you have any advice for growing lavender?
Hmm. Oh, where do you live?
In Madison. The farm is in Iowa County.
Okay, so you're farther south. So lavender, we can't really grow it up here because it's, it's just not hardy enough. But it's not hard to grow as far as I know. One of those things that it's an herb. It doesn't require anything out of the ordinary.
I've heard that it requires some sandy soil, and I don't have that. Maybe it doesn't really need that so badly.
It doesn't necessarily need to be sandy soil, but it does need to be well-drained soil. So you don't want to put it somewhere where it's going to be sitting in water or puddling, that sort of a thing.
Yeah. We had last year just at this time of the year, I was in Hawaii with a group of Wisconsin Public Radio listeners, and we visited a large lavender farm there, and it was kind of up on a hill. So it was the hillside was alive with the smell of lavender, as a matter of fact, and it was quite beautiful, and I guess they would have had really good drainage there on that hillside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen pictures and stuff of lavender is very popular in Hawaii, and that's got to be just an amazing scene to see
fields
of it.
Yeah, it was wonderful. And, of course, they had lavender.
The hillside, but other than that, I can't really do much to copy the Hawaiian weather.
No, that's for sure. But if you can do get well-drained soil, then you'll be all right.
Okay, good.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. I remember
you had the question about the corn too.
Oh, the corn. Sorry.
How far from the field corn is your corn going to be?
Say 30 yards.
So that's getting to be far enough that you probably don't really have to worry about it. I mean, they say that corn can pollinate up to 1,200 feet, but which direction is yours? Is your corn upwind or downwind from the field?
It would be upwind from it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're
so you're probably not going to have to worry about it too much.
Okay, very good. All right, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. I can remember a time back in my younger days where we were at a farm and they didn't have regular sweet corn, but they had field corn that was young, and we treated it like sweet corn, and it tasted really good, as I remember.
Right before the sugars start turning over to starches, when it's young and it's juicy and everything, it is very sweet.
Yep, it sure is. Barb in Stevens Point, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Barb.
I have a question about those pesky squirrels. I planted tulips and daffodils last year, and I dug the holes, put the bulbs in, covered with soil. However, instead of putting the chicken wire right in the hole, I just laid it on top and covered it with a little soil to hold the wire down. Well, now, when the plants are done blooming and have died back, I would like to plant something in its place. However, the wire is in the way. So here's my question. If I remove the wire, will the squirrels still dig up the bulbs?
Okay. So normally when you plant bulbs in the fall and then the squirrels come, like the next day and they dig them up and have a meal with them, it's really the freshly dug soil that attracts them to the area and lets them know that, hey, there's something there. So that's why you put on the chicken wire, because they can't dig through it, and then your bulbs can get established. So now when, like in the spring here, the squirrels probably aren't going to have a lot of interest in your bulbs, because they've been putting in roots as the in the fall, and so they have a root system, so they're going to be harder for a little squirrel to pull up and get out of there to begin with. And you're not going to have that freshly dug soil now this spring. So when the bulbs are done blooming and you cut them back, you can take that wire out of there so that you can plant in your other plants. And sure, you now have freshly dug soil, which might attract some squirrels to the area. But again, those bulbs are now, they're deep down and they're established. And so they're not likely going to be dug up so much. And then the other thing is, so you're planning on planting like some perennials in that area then?
Yeah. Right, right.
So then the bulbs will come up in spring, they'll die back, and then the perennials will be there.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
So now when you plant those perennials in there, what I would suggest is that you put a good layer of mulch, like a shredded wood mulch. Put it 3 to 4 inches deep around your perennials, not over the top of your newly planted perennials, but in the area between it. And that's going to cover up that freshly dug soil kind of a thing. And if the squirrels did want to dig down that, well, now they have to dig down through 3 inches of mulch plus 3 inches of soil to get down to a bulb that's already got a root system, and it's going to be hard for them to get up. So you're probably going to be okay.
There you go.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Barb, for calling. Appreciate it. We have lots of callers online and lots of emails and Facebooks. Paul emailed and wonders, is it true that cedar mulch or some other mulches keep weed growth down? I've certainly heard that with cedar mulch, but I don't know if it's true.
Well, I'm wondering if he's referring to the allelopathic capabilities of some things. And what that means is when a plant exudes some kind of a chemical or substance that knocks out the competition. So it keeps other plants from growing or other seeds from germinating. I'm not aware that cedar mulch has any specific allelopathic capability over other woods. It might, but I've never heard of it. But any wood mulch will keep weeds from growing if it's thick enough. And that's one of the problems. You need to make sure that when you put it on about 4 inches thick, and it'll settle down to about 3 inches. But with that kind of a depth, that shades out and smothers out weed seeds that are in the soil underneath, so they don't sprout. And if they were to sprout, they wouldn't get up above that mulch to where they can be doing photosynthesis and stuff, so they'll die off. So whether it's cedar or cypress or shredded hardwood mulch or pine bark, as long as you put it on thick enough so that it's dark at soil level, it shades out those seeds, it's going to do weed control. And the problem is, if you just put an inch of mulch on, that's not thick enough to stop weed seeds from germinating.
I like cedar mulch, especially when you get a rain.
Oh, it smells so good, doesn't it?
Oh, it smells wonderful.
And it does that for, like, years. You know,
you'd yes.
think that it would only smell great when it's fresh, but any time it's, even on a humid day, you know, 3 months later, you can smell it, and it is a great smell.
Marvin and Judah, it's your turn now. Thank you, Marvin.
I got kind of a three-part question about killing Japanese beetles grubs. About when the best time to apply a poison. I think there's a poison that'll kill them. But is that going to kill other grubs that are in the ground, firefly larvae?
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. The problem is these darn things is that they just get on the wind and they can... You eliminated everything, every one of them out of your lot... 5 minutes later, you can have a whole new batch from the neighbors.
That's right. So the Japanese beetles, they, you know, they come out in our area, it's about for the month of July. I think it might be a little earlier in southern Wisconsin. And they fly for about a month, and they feed on, you know, all the plants, linden trees and roses and things. And
grapes.
Grapes, oh, they love grapes. So they really, really love love that kind of stuff. So they do a lot of damage, but really that up above ground feeding doesn't typically kill the plants or damage them long term, because they just eat leaves off, and you know, new leaves can sprout or the buds are still there and that kind of thing. But then they lay their eggs in the soil in as they're done with that flight stage. So usually late July, that's when they're laying their eggs. And what they like for a place to lay their eggs is going to be moist mowed grass. So your lawn, if you irrigate your lawn, you're going to have more problems with them than if, you know, if it's a dry spell in the end of July when they want to lay their eggs, we don't have as many survive, because the little larvae, when they hatch in the soil, then they need to have good moisture. So so then the larvae are feeding on the grass roots, you know, end of the summer and then early spring, and then they pupate, and then they come out as adults again in our area, usually in July. So as far as when to put on the insecticides to kill the grubs, you would want them obviously when they're in the grub stage. And usually, I'm trying to think, May to mid-June is usually the best time to put that stuff on, because, again, that's going to kill the grubs before they go into the pupal stage and then come out as adults. But the problem, like Larry said, is that if you have grubs in your yard that are going to hatch to Japanese beetles, killing the grubs in your yard is not necessarily going to stop the adults from being in your yard and feeding on the plants in summer, because they fly in from your neighbors and everywhere else. And you also have to make sure that you truly have a grub problem. So if your grass is, if you've got irregularly shaped brown spots showing up in your lawn, and you don't know why, if you go and peel back some sod, you'll actually see those grubs right below the grass root level there. And if you have more than a couple per square foot, then you're justified in using an insecticide to try to kill those grubs. Not necessarily to protect your landscape plants from the adult feeding, but to protect your grass from the larva feeding on the roots. Will these insecticides kill other things? Yes, they will. You know, they can't tell a Japanese beetle grub from anything else. So you will indeed have a lot of other insects or things that are in the soil killed by the insecticides.
Unfortunately, yeah. Mm-hmm. So there you go, Marvin. It's just one of those things. You know, we've talked about this. Phil Pelletieri and I have talked about this many times. And Phil has said that and has noted that sometimes they go through stages. So you for a couple, 3 years, you have a terrible time with them. And then in many areas, then they start going back where there's fewer and fewer.
Right. Yeah, it does seem, especially when they first get to an area, like we've just gotten Japanese beetles in my county about 3 to 4 years ago. We hadn't had them up until then. And when they first show up, oh my gosh, they're really, really high numbers. Yep. And then over time, they're still going to be here. They're with us forever. But the numbers aren't as bad. But the weather conditions do play a big role in how high the population is going to be. So if we have a drought time, a real dry time in July and August the year before, we're less likely to have a large adult population the next year, because, again, those young grubs, they need to have moist soil. And if it's dry and the grass has gone dormant, those little grubs can't burrow down far enough to get to moisture. And so there's a lot of mortality then. And therefore, we just have fewer adults the next year. So it's hard to predict sometimes. And then winter, cold temperatures, how cold the soil freezes and how far down and for how long of a time, that can affect the populations as well.
Diana Althoff, our guest today, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Diana Althoff, UW Extension horticulture educator in Pierce County. And we have open lines. Yeah, we have got a couple of open lines. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also go to our Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post a photo, questions, or comments there, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Dodie in Mineral Point up next. Thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a garden problem. I had two maple trees in my front gardens, and they got cut down because they got involved in my sewer system. And I used them as planters for 20 years, you know, put plants on top of them. Finally, they had rotted enough. So I burned them last fall. What can I do to that soil so the flowers will take off in there?
So you're saying where the stumps were, you want to plant a flower bed?
Well, there was flowers around the stump, and I just burned the stump out.
Okay.
And now there's this pile of ash and stuff in there. Is there any way I can make that soil healthy?
Well, you've got some challenges there because when you burn wood, wood ash is super, super high pH, and it releases, there's magnesium, phosphorus issues and stuff there. So probably the best thing to do, so it's burned, I'm assuming, down to ground level and then below
And below, yes.
Yeah, and then there are roots and stuff that are still in the soil, and they'll decompose over time. So I guess my suggestion would be to try to scoop out as much of that wood ash and, you know, whatever's left of the stump kind of thing as possible. Mm-hmm. And then if you can bring in some fresh, clean soil from another garden area or something to replace
compost
that. Yeah, compost would be good, but compost will decompose over time, and that root system is going to decompose, so you're going to get settling as time goes on. So if you bring in some actual soil that has the sand, silt, or clay in it, you'll reduce the amount of quick settling that's going in there.
Okay.
Are you looking to plant annuals in this space or perennials?
Mostly perennials.
Okay, so then you really don't want to deal with a whole lot of settling because eventually you'll end up with a puddle there. So what I would suggest is actually to mound it up a little bit because you know it's going to settle over time as that root system rots away.
You're
So I would scoop out as much of that ash stuff as you can, replace it with some more soil, work that up as much as you can, and then I'd do a soil test and really see where your pH is at, because if your pH is high, again, because wood ash does raise the pH, then you might need to add some sulfur in there to get the pH down to where you want it to be. And so that way you'll get off to a good start. And over time, stuff is going to kind of settle back down. So the effects of that burning and the effects of that rotting wood and stuff will, you know, lessen each year. But if you want to get those plants off to a good start, we always say they need good soil to get started.
Yep, they sure do.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. You know, I think she said 20 years it's been. Those roots have got to be.
Yeah, they're rotting. I'm guessing she's maybe having some mushrooms in the grass around that area, too, because as those roots rot, they'll decompose with fungi, and, you know, you get mushrooms that pop up and that kind of a thing. So, it's well on its way to decomposing, I would imagine.
Annalisa in Green Bay, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Someone called in about lavender earlier.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to mention that there is a commercial lavender farm in at Washington Island in Door County, and they've been there several years. I'm sure you can Google them. and find them. They have talked about how there are many varieties of lavender, and they found one that works for them up there. So I wonder if they could be helpful to this person who's looking for something for his garden.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, and you know, there's those microclimates over there on the East Coast that, you know, they can grow things that we in the inner parts of the state can't.
Mm-hmm. But there are so many different, I think that was one of the things about the Hawaii trip, was that there were so many different types of lavender. It was amazing to me.
Yeah, and there's a lot of uses for lavender as well, so you can pick the right kind for what you want to use it for.
Yeah, they were selling all different kinds of things relating with lavender. Greg in River Falls, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yes. So actually, I'm just the crow flies about 2 miles from the River Falls campus, and I bought an old farm site. Got about 13 acres. And there's a few prairie sections that I'd like to actually convert back to old, original native prairie land with some wildflowers and native grasses. What's the best procedure to clear the land and then start over?
Okay, so when you say that it's currently like grassland, old pasture or something like that.
So, yeah, and there's some like buckthorn growing in there now, but a lot of grasses, and the black-eyed Susans and some original, you know, native flowers growing there.
Okay.
That's what you'd like. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
yep.
And what I'm guessing that is there right now is a lot of quack grass, probably brome grass, things like that, that are non-native cool season grasses. So they're not prairie grasses. And then you've got some things that have popped in there, like black-eyed Susans and obviously the buckthorn we want to go because that's mm-hmm. our number one public enemy invasive plant. So if you want to turn it into a true restored prairie situation, then what you have to do is to get rid of all that grass that's there already, because that's not native prairie grass kind of thing. And there's a couple of ways you can do it. It's similar to what we were talking about earlier in the show where the that ornamental grass was creeping in. These brome grass and quack grass and stuff all spreads by underground roots, and those root systems are tremendous on the fortitude that they have. So it takes a lot to kill them. So in most cases, when people are going to do a restored prairie, you mow everything off, all that old stuff, cut out the woody plants that are coming in, the buckthorn or honeysuckle or box elders or whatever is in the way that you don't want there, and then you spray it with an herbicide. And again, that's glyphosate because it kills everything. And then you wait a couple weeks and see if anything green is popping up, and then you probably spray it again so that you're sure that you kill all those weeds. And then you can, there's two things you can do. You can till it up and then plant your prairie seed mix, or you can hire someone who has a native seed no-till planter, and they can plant into that dead sod. Personally, my experience is tilling it up, you get a better catch with that stuff. But you also then bring up weed seeds, so you have that to deal with. And then when you plant the new prairie seed, it's a case where you need to mow it a couple of times that first year because you're mowing off those weeds that are sprouting up from the seed bank. And then the next year, you probably have to mow it once or twice as well. It takes a while for a native prairie planting to really get established, but it's well worth it. But the key to getting a good prairie situation is to get rid of that existing non-native grass and those root systems. And again, that brome and quack grass in there, maybe bluegrass in there, because those aren't native prairie grasses, and they will, because they're sod-forming grasses, they will choke out and take over the bunch grasses that are the native prairie grasses and things over time. So that's why it's so important that you have a clean start when you do that. And as far as where you get the seed, there's several places around. Prairie Nursery down by Madison's one of my favorites. They have all kinds of things where you can get the native prairie grasses as well as the forbs, the flowers, mm-hmm. the black-eyed Susans, and all those cool native prairie plants that support all the pollinators that we really need to be providing habitat for. And the more variety of different kinds of those forbs that you put in your prairie, the better it is for the pollinators.
Yeah, there you go.
Now, how would you go about finding out if the actual grasses that you got there are, you know, bad grasses or, you know, actually prairie grasses or good grasses?
Well, because you're in River Falls, are you in Pierce County?
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So all you have to do is come and see me. And that's for anybody in the state. You know, your extension office is there to help you with just this kind of thing. So you can bring some into my office and we can identify them. A lot of times we identify things via good digital pictures, if that's more convenient. And, you know, so that's step number one, is just identifying them. So you can contact me in the Pierce County office and, like I said, dig up different kinds of grasses that you have, come and bring them in, and we'll identify them to see for sure what they are.
Mm-hmm.
So are you based down in Pierce County, or down in Ellsworth then, or are you right there at the university?
I'm down in Ellsworth.
Okay. All right.
Yep. And you can just send me an email and we can... We can set something up.
Okay. And could I get your email? Or even your office? And
yep. If you just Googled Pierce County UW Extension, you would find our office website. And then my email's on there. But my email address is my name, diana.alfuth, and it's at ces.uwex.edu.
You got all that? Once more, maybe.
Diana. It's Diana, D-I-A-N-A, dot, Alfuth, A-L-F-U-T-H, at C-E-S, dot, U-W-E-X, dot, E-D-U.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Greg, you're off to a good start with some great help from Diana Alfuth. Diana is a horticulture educator for the University of Wisconsin Extension. As she just said, she works out of Pierce County and teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. So happy to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today for this edition of Garden Talk as we visit with Diana Alfuth, is the Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County, also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. And today she joins us from our WPR studios in Eau Claire. There's a lot of great advice here to share. And certainly we hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Post a photo or question on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, or you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Judy in Grafton next. Judy, hi. Thank you for waiting.
Okay, you're welcome, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had called a couple weeks ago and talked to you about my winter sowing project, where I sow cold weather crops and seeds that reseed, you know, through the winter and come up in spring, into milk jugs. I cut them in half, put soil in the bottom half, put the seeds in, and then close it with tape, but leave the top open, leave the cracks on the side. Don't tape it tight. Anyway, as you started talking today, I ran out and checked. I now have lettuce, spinach, and radishes up in my little winter sowing jug.
Oh,
how fun.
Yeah, it works just great. And I work at a care center, and I do it with the residents. And, you know, they start getting really itchy come February to start planting. And so I was showing them this week that we have things popping up. And that we just put them outside and let them get snowed on, rained on. But we find the plants, I've done this now the third year, the plants are very hardy. They come up when they're ready. They don't get leggy. It's just like a, what do you call it? The guy called earlier.
It's a mini cold frame.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's what it is.
It's a mini cold frame and a fun way to do things. And you're right. They come up when they're ready. So they wait until, you know, the soil within that little milk jug thing is warm enough. And because they're out in bright light, the bright sunlight, that's why they don't get leggy. So even though within that jug, you know, like I don't know what the weather's like in the rest of the state, but it's a sunny day here today, even though it's only like 32 degrees.
Yep.
But inside that little milk jug, it's warmer than that. And so nice bright light and warmer temperatures than outside. So those plants are happy in those conditions. So good for you.
Yeah. Thanks,
Judy. Yeah, if anyone is interested, just look up winter sowing, all one word, and it's S-O-W-I-N-G on the internet, and there's a big description of how to do it.
Great.
Thank you, Judy. Okay. That's great. She did call a couple weeks ago, and I thought, oh, that sounds so wonderful.
That's the way to really get a jump on the growing season and really get out of those late winter blues.
So winter sowing, all one word. Maybe we could even put a link on our Facebook page. Cheyenne, maybe you can do that for us. Winter sowing is the place. Doug in Hortage, you are next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I have an alternative that I'd like to recommend for people that are trying to kill off their vegetation, like the man who wants to restore his native prairie, yeah, rather than using the glyphosate.
Uh-huh.
It's a bit more elbow grease, but I've done it. I've done it on large areas, and I think it works even better. And that's just black plastic.
Yeah.
You put down black plastic, you hold it in place for about a month, and it not only kills off what's growing, it kills an awful lot of the weed seeds that are dormant in the soil because it overheats it.
And you're right, that is an option. I think the gentleman that called in though said he had 13 acres, and so...
he had 13 acres with spots of prairie.
Yeah.
Most of it wasn't prairie.
But if you have a small enough space that you're doing it, you're right. Black plastic can do it, and basically it blocks the light out from those plants. So remembering that a plant's food is the sugars that it creates during photosynthesis. So if it's in the dark, you basically starve those plants out. And normally, though, depending on what the vegetation is underneath and what you need to get rid of, if it is quack grass, because those roots are they have store so much energy in, normally the recommendations are that you would cover it for a full growing season. So you're going to be, you know, really taking some time to do it. But if it's not quack grass, if it's less tenacious weeds, black plastic can be a great option to smother things out and kill them out. Another option is just repeated tillage, where you till it up, and then like every 2 weeks, as soon as anything starts sprouting green, you till it up again, because again, that's a way to starve out the root systems. But it does take more effort, like you say, more elbow grease, more mm-hmm. effort, more time. And but it is a good option if that's the way you want to go.
Sure thing. Doug, thank you, appreciate the call. I want to give Peter a chance to join us from La Crosse. Peter, yeah. Hi.
Well, thanks for taking the call. Listen, I've been waiting for 3 or 4 years to make this call.
Ooh.
So my question is more about wildflowers, but I want to get your guest's opinion. So it goes like this. I'm a bicyclist, and I bicycle with my daughter. And we bicycle up this one road called County MM. It goes by the Shrine of Guadalupe in between Mount La Crosse. It goes about 600 feet from bottom to top and just a little over a mile. So because I go with my daughter and she's faster, it kind of pains me. So she says, let's do Zen biking. Let's count the flowers as we go up. So, we have identified more than 300 flowers from bottom to top in just that little over a mile's time, and the shoulder of the road is only a couple feet on either side. To one side, it goes off over the ledge, and the other side, it goes up into the bluffs. And this is heavily salted. And there just isn't much space. But we have counted that many flowers. Until that time, I didn't even know that Wisconsin had that many wildflowers.
Yeah.
Then I got every flower book, and we started checking this off. And this, the flowers grow from March till December. And I want, you know, I'm just dumbfounded. Unfortunately, the county started poisoning the sides of the road now because it's so hard to cut. But there are still, even last year, even with the cutting, there were still, you know, weren't as diligent, but there were still probably 200 different flowers over the course of the year. Can you respond to that? Because this is absolutely astounding to me.
Yeah, that's what a cool idea, by the way.
You know, my husband's a big bicyclist, and so I end up bicycling a lot, too. And those hills are killer. So what a great idea. Next time I'm climbing up a hill, I'm going to be counting flowers.
Except it does hurt your neck because you have to, those little flowers, you have to strain so hard to see them because we don't get off. So we go back and walk it to count them later. But about the number of flowers, can you?
You know what? There are thousands of species of native plants to Wisconsin. And obviously not everything you're seeing is probably necessarily native, but they're still flowers. And I just think it's so cool that you are noticing that because, you know, if you're driving by in a car and stuff, you just don't notice the diversity and the amazing number of different things that are, you know, eking out a living in different places. So, you know, as a horticulturist, it doesn't dumbfound me that there are that many species, but it is really, really intriguing to me that you see that many species along that one road, that one space. And the other thing that you're probably experiencing is if it's a 600-foot climb, you've got different climates from top to bottom.
Right.
And so you're probably getting things where things are growing at the top that could not grow at the bottom,
yes. And
vice versa. And obviously, if it's very heavily salted, you're also looking at a lot of salt tolerant plants. So that's, you know, an indication of, well, some of those plants, if they're thriving there, those would be good plants to plant elsewhere where roads get salted and salt builds up in soil and that sort of a thing. So, you know, the number of insects and plants that grow in the state is in the thousands, and it's incredible. And like I said, I just think it's really great that you're noticing them, and what a great way to make it up that hill.
That's really a wonderful idea, Peter. Thank you so much. I was thinking back to last time I biked the Grabar, which is that 500-mile bike ride. The amount that you see along the roadsides of everything. I didn't realize there would be so many dead animals, for example, but the flowers and other plants are just amazing.
It is, and that's what's really neat about bicycling is you see those things. You smell different smells.
Mm-hmm.
You notice things more than, you know, if you're just buzzing by in a car with the radio blaring and stuff, and I think that's one of the appealing things of bicycling, not to mention the great exercise that you get.
Yeah, wonderful exercise. And Peter, thank you again for calling. I really appreciate it. What a great idea. I'm gonna try that too. There's a couple of hills that I don't like so well either.
All the bicyclists listening are going to be counting wildflowers up the hills now. It's a good way to keep your mind off of how painful your thighs are feeling.
Oh, Diana Alfoth, our guest today. We have open lines. We get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. Dan in central Wisconsin wanted to know how to grow hops. And do you know of any resources from UW Extension that could help?
Oh, absolutely. You know, hops are one of those things that are really catching on in interest right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of individuals and groups in Wisconsin that are trying to bring back the hops to Wisconsin. You know, way back, Wisconsin was the number one hops producer. And then it kind of went to the Pacific Northwest. And part of that is because there are some diseases that we get in Wisconsin that are a problem with growing hops. But there they're not hard to grow. Hops are big, tall vines, and so you need a trellis, a support system. And you know, most of the hop yards where people grow hops in large numbers are like 10 feet tall.
At least
trellises, and you know, they have to be way, way up there, and so the hops then are the flowers of these vines, and they bring in the that's what's used to flavor the beer, and mm-hmm. so there's different varieties depending on what kind of effect you want on the beer, and bitter or whatever. So they're not necessarily hard to grow, as far as they don't need anything super different for soil structure or pH or, you know, fertility, that sort of a thing. But you just need to have that trellising system. You need to pick the varieties that are hardy here, that are going to be the type that you want. And then, yes, UW Extension does have materials for hops. And I know we have like four or five new fact sheets on hops of the diseases and viruses, things that hops get to tell you what to look for. And we have some state specialists who have been doing work on hops. So if you want information on hops, you can just Google UW Extension and hops, or you can contact your local county extension office, and they can help you getting some of those resources that are available on actually how to grow them and how to set up the trellises, where to get the hops. I know one of the biggest things is when you get the plants, you want to make sure that you get disease-free plants that have been certified free of some of the problems with them. But not hard to do. I have an ornamental hop plant that grows up a big trellis at my house. And I don't, you know, harvest them or anything, but they're, you know, it's been there probably 7 or 8 years now, and every year it just grows up. It's this massive jungle of a plant, and so they're really good for, like, growing on fences. If you want screening and privacy, ornamental hops are great, but they're not really good if you actually want to use them to flavor beer. So you want to make sure that you get the correct variety and don't end up with an ornamental one if you do want to use it for beer.
One of the places that really does a good job, commercial places, is Gorst Valley Hops.
Yeah.
They're very good. And G-O-R-S-T, Gorst Valley Hops. And they sell hops, too. But they also have a lot of information about growing hops on their website.
Yes, they do. And they're down in the southwestern side
right.
of the state. And they're kind of a co-op where they've mm-hmm. got a lot of hop growers that have started there. Mazamani, I think, is where they're out of. And
yep.
And I think they have a processing facility near Madison, maybe Middleton or something mm-hmm. like that. And they were kind of the leaders in kind of reviving the hop stuff in the area. So they have got a lot of great information. They do workshops and stuff as well. So
really
definitely,
good source.
Yeah, a good source.
Dan and Marinette, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just two quick follow-ups. First of all, I've got some close friends up here in the Marinette area who are actually working with Gorse Valley in establishing a small commercial hop yard. And it's been really fun to see them get involved in this over the last couple of years. A huge amount of work to get it going, but boy, they're pretty impressive plants once you get to the end of the summer.
They are. They're huge.
Yeah. The second thing I wanted to follow up on was the fellow who was talking about counting the wildflowers. And just to relate an experience we had last summer, we were driving through southern Minnesota through just miles and miles and miles of cropland down there. And a family member riding along with us pointed out that there were essentially no flowers at all in any of the ditches for miles and miles. And we were thinking about all of the bees and other pollinators who essentially were living in a food desert. And it was really pretty shocking once we started looking around. And it almost was like a panicky kind of thing, like, oh, my gosh, there are no flowers through here. And then when we got back into Wisconsin, we noticed how even in some of the farming areas, the plethora of flowers that were in the ditches. So is there a state law that essentially prohibits, like, the mowing of ditches or something? Because there seemed to be an awful lot of that going on in Minnesota, where they were, the farmers were mowing the ditches, but not so much here in Wisconsin.
Well, you know, I don't know necessarily about what the laws are and stuff. I know in Wisconsin, the townships and counties do mow the ditches, but there is a law that they can't do it before, I want to say July 1st or July 15th or something, because that's the ground nesting bird season, mm-hmm. and the ground nesting birds are out of them then. So that might help to get the wildflowers a chance to get going, and maybe, you know, we have more of that. Unfortunately, we also have some not so great things that grow in the ditches, like wild parsnip, which has really taken over in some places as an invasive plant. And in that way, it'd be nice if we did mow a little bit sooner to knock off those seed heads before they mature. But as far as you know, I know, if you want to mow your ditch, nobody stops you. You know, I mean, it's even though that's, you know, public right of way and stuff, unless there's some kind of a thing, like I say, with the ground nesting birds and stuff, I don't think the towns or the counties care if you take care of mowing their ditches for them. And so it may just be you know, the area that you were in, that was the neighborhood practice, was to mow all the ditches. But that is really a big concern, and why there's a lot of concern about pollinator health and pollinator activity and pollinator survival, because, you know, we used to have fence rows that had wildflowers and milkweed and things growing up them. And now, you know, the farms have gone you know, fence line to fence line, and there are no fence lines with weeds growing up on them anymore. And because we are worried about invasive species, we're killing, you know, or mowing, and it is a major concern. And so, you know, now there's efforts to plant areas that will have the flowers for the pollinators, and you know, to help bolster some of these species that are getting scaringly low. And so it's an interesting observation, and that's what's great about the gentleman that called earlier that has this 13 acres and he wants to put some areas back into prairie that's going to have some of these flowers and this diversity of vegetation, because that's what we need, because it has been knocked out in so many cases.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot, Dan, for calling. I appreciate it. You know, we had an email from Doug who said there's a lot of talk about raising and lowering soil pH. What are proper soil pH numbers? And I guess it depends a little on what you're growing, but...
Well, that's a great question, though, because, you know, it's funny when I have a class and I ask people, what is pH and why does it matter? And people always say, oh, it's acidic or basic or alkalinity of the soil. And I say, well, what is that? Why does that matter? Why do we care? And I get silence. Because we know that pH is important, but not everybody understands why. And so
you've got about 1 minute to tell me.
Okay, we can do that. So what... Why pH matters is it affects the plant's ability to take up nutrients out of the soil. So if the pH is too high or too low for that plant's not able to take up all the other nutrients that it needs. And that's why it's important. So what's appropriate will vary depending on the plant. So we have some plants that have evolved in highly acidic areas like blueberries and azaleas. You know, they evolved in peat bogs where the pH is really low. So they need a low pH in order to take nutrients up out of the soil. Other plants, the majority of them, if you're somewhere between 6.5 and 7.2, most plants are going to be happy with that. So it does matter based on what the plant is. We have some of these that need it, you know, at an extreme, but for the most part, somewhere between 6.5 and 7.2, you're going to be doing just fine.
Diana, you're a real peach. You do a great job.
We can't grow peaches up here, unfortunately. I wish we could, but
you're a peach. You're a peach anyway. You've done a wonderful job as always, and I look forward to having us get together again. Thank you so much.
Well, it's great to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me, and you're a peach too.
Diana Alfeth is a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Pierce County, teaches landscape design as the UW River Falls as well. Great to have her along. She does a wonderful job. And I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's always kind of the way it works. Just to look ahead, Monday at 11, folks from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center will talk about research replacing corn with perennial grasses for use in biofuel production. Then at 11:45, our weather guys come by to talk about spring severe weather and, of course, a whole lot more. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.